there, everybody, and welcome to the TCU podcast for February 2015, first of the new year. I am your host, Richard Jansen Parks. Joining me today is our editor, Adam Duckett.
Hello.
And senior staff reporter, Helen Tunnicliffe.
Hello.
So today we are going to be running you through the latest news in the world of chemical and process engineering. We'll be taking a look at how graphene is creeping its way into our future, innovative ways of dealing with plastics waste, and why chemical engineers need to communicate better.
Proper. Need to communicate proper.
For our lead news story this month, well, it's sort of the one story that everyone around the world's been reporting on for months now, it feels like, which is, of course, oil is at an all-time, well, not an all-time low, but it's at a incredibly low price compared to how it was. I mean, it's, what, 60% drop over the past 6 months?
That's right, yep, 60% down.
It's been results a season for Q4 of 2014, and lots and lots and lots of job cuts have been announced, and budget cutbacks and all that entails.
It's been some really, really big numbers.
There really has. Up in the North Sea, what is it, BP are cutting 300-ish jobs?
Yeah, BP's announced that it's going to be cutting 200 staff positions and 100 contractors in its North Sea operations. And Bob Dudley, BP CEO, came out today and said that he's freezing pay for all BP staff across the world for the whole of 2015.
And I think that Talisman as well are cutting similar-ish numbers in the North Sea.
Yeah, 300 people, 10% of its staff.
One of the areas that seems to be sort of worst affected by all of this is the oil services industry, who in fact I think we talked about last month with the tie-up between Halliburton and Baker Hughes. Well, the biggest three players in that industry, which are those two and Schlumberger, are cutting at least 17,000 jobs.
It's a cyclical industry. There's always been ups and downs and rounds, but, you know, whenever it happens, it's going to hurt quite a lot. One of the biggest concerns, and Judith Hackett, head of the HSE and former ICME president, talks about this in her guest catalyst in TC this month, says the biggest concern, well, one of her largest concerns, is that as the oil price drops, companies will be tempted to cut their health and safety spend, whether that be maintenance activities on oil rigs or safety training for staff workers. And as was shown in the 90s when the oil price plummeted, companies that kind of think that it makes sense to cut safety spend, cut costs quickly in areas that they don't think are going to have a long-term impact, history shows that it will have a long-term impact. So she's pleading with companies to make sure that they don't cut costs in safety-critical areas.
Well, to get an idea of how engineers might have their careers shaped by the plummeting price of oil, we've spoken to Mark Stracey from the Thomas Telford Recruitment Agency. Obviously, with the falling price of oil, things are looking not great for engineers who work in the oil and gas sector. So I was just wondering if you had sort of any insight into what the effect this might have on people's careers and what they can best do to work around these problems.
At the risk of sounding a bit doom-laden and pessimistic, which I was of the degradation, really, I think there is little point in pretending that this is not significant. There have been slowdowns and momentary pauses in the otherwise ascendant development of the industry. I do, however, agree with one or two more silver-haired commentators like myself that this could be the sort of biggest potential interruption to that long, generally upward trend since 86. And I think it is worth bearing in mind that a lot of engineers who will by now be mid-career have probably experienced little else than a continuous upward cycle. So I think this is psychologically and in practical terms going to be a bit of a shock, and one whose waves possibly won't pass for a while. In the current market, I think that options are tough. I think it is going to take a lot of thinking around for engineers over the next year, possibly 2 years.
You mentioned the challenges. Are there any opportunities presented by this? Because presumably a low oil price is actually quite a good news for companies that whose business involves buying and refining, for example, oil. So is there a chance of there being more jobs created in those sectors?
I think that's the hope. I think I hope that, and I think one or two commentators think that. With oil at the price it is, one would hope that sort of petrochemicals particularly would enjoy a more supportive market and more supportive conditions for expansion and investment. In the States, that does seem to be the case. There have been a number of new ethylene plants commissioned over there, and there does seem to be some prospect of complex petrochemicals suffering being awarded new development projects. In the UK, there is a slight complication, I think, in the sense that some of the, not all, but some of the petrochemical manufacturers, or those manufacturing petrochemicals, are also sort of integrated energy majors who have substantial upstream exposure. And I think they are just trying to adjust to see where the cash is best suited.
In your experience, how hard is it for someone to transition from one sector to another? Would a recruiter be interested, for example, if they were in the water sector, in someone who had, as you say, 5 to 10 years experience in oil and gas? Or would they be interested in them at all?
I think, Richard, there are two answers to that question. I think as a long-term trend, migration and interdiscipline transfer is on the decline. I think that's the general long-term trend. If I could bore you with a sort of a specific to illustrate and support my point, I think back in the 70s, possibly even before that, I wouldn't know, but certainly back in the 70s and 80s, I think senior chemical engineers, particularly chartered chemical engineers, were considered to be highly adaptable, flexible individuals, and it was perfectly reasonable to expect them to design and specify plant for any nominated subject area. So engineers with major EPC players like Foster Wheeler would have enjoyed a very varied and fruitful existence addressing what these days would be considered to be quite mutually exclusive sectors. 1 minute they'd be designing a pharmaceutical and a biochemical plant, the next an ethylene plant, paraxylene the next, biotech the next. It was generally accepted that chemical engineers would be adequate to the needs of any sector. I think that over time has changed. I think there is a lot more resistance and there's a lot more expectation on the demand on the part of clients who are paying the bill ultimately, that is the operating companies, the owners of the assets that are being developed via the contractor. I think those asset owners are now exerting significantly more pressure on their suppliers to ensure that people that are assigned to their projects are pre-qualified in the particular sectors. The other answer, coming back to my original point, is that it is cycle specific. So in times of great demand, I think where clients are struggling to get talent that's been exposed to their particular technologies and sector, there is more flexibility and largesse. In more tempered times, when demand is more in equipoise, then clients, where they can, will look for very more exact fits in terms of candidates' aptitudes and suitability. Nonetheless, within time, it could well be that increased demand again will see greater client flexibility and tolerance and a readiness to underwrite skill transfers in the absence of qualities and competence that's very particular to their industry. understand the interest in looking at the positives and I think it's also important for candidates and people in the industry to understand the realities of the challenges, because I think it makes them sort of better prepared and galvanizes people more. I think it encourages people potentially to waste quite a lot of time if too much potential is suggested, or I think glib suggestions about what can be done in difficult times often leads to disillusionment and disappointment. So I think it's important to strike a balance between encouragement and natural thinking and working around problems, and also to raise false expectation too, really.
The sharp-eared, if that's a phrase, among you may remember that in our very first TCU podcast, we had a piece on the lack of new antibiotics and the risks that posed. Well, there may be a new weapon in the war against superbugs. Helen, I think that you covered this.
I did, yes. Well, there is now a new antibiotic class, which is quite exciting. The last antibiotic class to be developed for human use was discovered in 1987, which is a long time ago. I can just about remember 1987.
I wasn't born then.
Yeah, let's not talk about that.
Hey, it's Rick's first ever new antibiotic.
Yay! But this is really, really exciting, because obviously there's a lot of problems with sort of resistant superbugs like MRSA and TB as well is becoming an increasing problem, because there's some strains that are resistant to pretty much every antibiotic they can throw at them. So there's a group at Northeastern University in the US led by a professor called Kim Lewis, finally found a way to cultivate soil bacteria. Now, obviously there are lots of bacteria in soil, and you think, well, how hard can it be to cultivate them? Well, very, apparently. There was 99% of them can't be cultivated in the laboratory until now. Kim Lewis and his group have invented what they call the iChip, which is sort of it's a central plate covered in tiny little holes, and each one of those contains a single bacteria suspended in agar. So this plate can then be covered with membranes and then put back in the soil. So rather than trying to recreate conditions in the soil, which is really hard, they just put them back in the soil. But because they're in this chip, the compounds that the bacteria actually make can just be sort of siphoned off. So you can still collect the bacteria. So that's quite exciting. A company set up by Lewis and another professor that he worked with, Slava Epstein, called Nova Biotic Pharmaceuticals, have now screened 50,000 different strains of bacteria in these little individual holes and found 25 new antibiotics. But Texabactin, this new one, is quite exciting because they can't find any method of resistance to it. See, what normally happens with an antibiotic is that it binds to proteins within the cell, within the bug of whatever it's trying to attack. And so obviously a bacteria or whatever can develop resistance as the proteins evolve to be stronger and be able to resist the antibiotic. But in this case, Texabactin actually binds to lipids found in the cell membrane and breaks it apart that way rather than the proteins. And lipids, as far as they can tell, don't really evolve. So it looks like this might be able to kill all sorts of things.
Has this actually been tested, or is it just sort of in theory right now?
No, it's been tested. They infected a load of mice with a dose of MRSA, which would normally kill them.
Poor mice.
Yeah. And they treated some of them and not others, and the treated mice all lived.
Wow.
So yes, this stuff does actually work.
It's a big step in the right direction by the sounds of it.
Yeah, nice. It sounds really exciting.
Next we have Bill Gates drinks poo. Sort of. Slightly, technically no, but Adam, you had
human
a look
poo.
At this one. Yes.
Duck it.
Suddenly all eyes are on me.
All eyes are on you.
Essentially, there has been a video going round of Bill Gates drinking a glass of water that 5 minutes earlier was, well, human poo. There's no other way of putting it. Look for it online. Might be the dream video for all of those that had to struggle through Windows Vista.
I love Windows Vista. I still have Windows Vista.
You're a strange human being.
All joking aside, though, Bill Gates has put his hand in his pocket, pulled out a huge wad of cash, and is funding a company called Yaniki Bioenergy to scale up this new wastewater treatment facility that they're developing that will allow you to put human waste in one end, and out of the other end will come fresh water that you can drink, as Bill Gates did. A glass of water. Gobbled it down, though I know some of us doubt whether or not it was true.
I don't think you watch the video, right? At the very end, he does that thing where you're pretending to try something, and you put the glass to your lips, touch it to your lips, pretend to swallow, and then go, delicious.
In fairness,
like you do when a toddler hands you a plastic cup.
In fairness, I'm not entirely sure that I'd be willing to even let feces water touch my lips, even if I didn't have to actually imbibe it. That's a step further than I'm willing to go with most things. So I sort of think, even if that is true, fair play to him, I think, still.
No, he gulped it down. You could see his mouth moving. You could see him swallowing it. He definitely did. Anyway, the system essentially will help save some 700,000 children who are killed by poor sanitation every year. And the one unit could produce 86,000 litres a day of potable water. It could consume the waste from 100,000 people, and at the same time generate 25 kilowatts of electricity. So really, really clever idea. And the company will be testing it in Senegal later this year.
So does the power part, is that a biogas, or do they like have something with the a solids waste? Or,
well, the way the process works is that the sewage sludge that's fed into the front end is boiled, which splits the water from the solid waste. The dry solids are then fed into a boiler to produce high pressure steam that's then used to power the process, and then the excess energy can be sold to the local community.
Very nice.
Have you seen the BP Process Safety Series book collection that we offer? Produced in collaboration with BP, the series aims to help the reader understand safe operating practices and procedures within process plants. They are also now available as ebooks for you to read on the go. Visit www.ichemie.org/shop to view the collection, or email sales@ichemie.org.
As long as we've been using plastics, we've had the dilemma of what to do with them after throwing them away. While recycling technology has improved, we still have to dispose of huge quantities of plastic every year. In an article they wrote for us this month, Sam Haig and his colleagues at Axion Recycling set out some innovative new takes on how we can turn this problem into an opportunity. So obviously we don't want to go through the entire article, but one point that in particular stood out for me was, so the conventional wisdom has always been that sending plastics, especially to landfill, is sort of a bad idea both environmentally and economically, but your work suggests otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, sending plastics to landfill with everything else is a problem, because it gets mixed up with everything and then it sits in the landfill for several years, fermenting into whatever around it happens, all the organics and things. But if you had a system where you could collect the plastics that you can't currently recycle separately, and store them in a what you might call a landfill, some sort of specialist storage facility, until technology or economics had changed to the point where you could recycle that material, then you could extract it, and since it's already had a sort of preliminary separation by being collected separately, then that makes your job 5 years in the future, or whenever it is, a whole lot easier.
So is the idea, in essence, to sort of create a plastic mine for future technologies to extract?
Yeah, that's a very good way of thinking about it. As recyclers, we always consider the household waste and all sorts of other waste to be some kind of urban mine, and that's a very good phrase of way of thinking about it. So if you can think of it as mining valuable materials, but just from a different type of mine, if you could do a preliminary sorting step before, at this stage, and then you can come back to it later once you've created a very rich mine of materials.
Hmm. Is it... So, obviously, this all hinges on the theory that one day we will be able to recycle, to process these plastics. Is that a reasonable assumption to make, that all of the plastics that we have now, we will at some point get the technology to process?
I don't think it's completely unreasonable if you think about the current recycling sector, you know, for plastics in particular. Maybe 15, 20 years ago, there just wasn't the infrastructure that there is now. And thinking about the recycling that happens now, it's come on a huge way from where we were several tens of years ago. And there's plenty of work being done on recycling these currently unrecyclable materials like plastic films, such as some work that we did, I think it was last year, a couple of years ago, proving that you could take end-of-life household post-use plastic film material and process it right through to a new or a recycled pellet that you could then reuse into new materials. So technically it's all possible. The current challenge is the economics.
Hmm. What could be done to make this economical then?
That's a difficult question. There are lots of challenges with plastic films because of the difficulties in handling them, and they're quite lightweight. It's a question that at the moment is, like I said, very, very difficult to answer. I think one of the key things that will really help, and you know, is obviously going on at the moment, is improving the technologies, making them more available, cheaper essentially, to implement.
So, from one seemingly omnipresent material to one that we cannot get enough of, we turn to Helen, who recently visited 2D Tech in Manchester, a UK. What did you find there, Helen?
Graphene.
Lots of it?
Little tiny flakes of it.
Fair enough.
Because that's all there is.
That's all there is. Graphene production has come a long way from sellotape. I'm sure you remember from all those years ago. How many years ago now? 11 years ago, they found graphene. 2004, Gaiman Novoselov. At the University of Manchester, discovered that you can make graphene by taking a pencil lead and getting a piece of sellotape, sticking it to the lead, peeling it off, and then sticking another piece of sellotape to the sellotape, peeling that off, and peeling repeatedly until they finally got a tiny little thin layer of graphene, which of course is the little stack layers that make up graphite. So it was very exciting. But then how do you make it on a grand scale? You can't just sit there and... Every time somebody wants some graphene, send them...
Don't worry about it, it'll be 4 hours.
Here's a pencil and a roll of sellotape. Okay, then. That's not going to work. So there's been lots of developments in trying to scale it up, but there's one particular company that I went to visit in Manchester, which is actually a University of Manchester spin-off company, called 2D Tech. It's headed up by a guy called Nigel Salter. They're basically making graphene. The company was set up to produce research samples and sort of samples for sale, prototypes for sale. Now it's sort of branching out, doing all sorts of things. It's setting up commercial operations in Gloucestershire. And yeah, they should hopefully be able to sell lots of graphene, which means the exciting part, we'll be able to do lots more things with it.
Like what?
Well, obviously the big thing that everybody talks about is touchscreens. Because mine's still made with indium tin oxide, and all of yours are too. Because they're still trying to find ways to make these things big enough. But the big companies are putting all the money into all the expensive high-end stuff. But there's lots of other things that graphene can help with too, and that's what companies that 2D Tech are trying to do. So they formed a partnership with the National Graphene Institute, so they're better linked with the academic world, and they can find more things to do with it, and they're just trying to help researchers, really. So they've got two ways of making graphene. The first one is basically, it starts with graphite and basically involves making it thinner somehow. So what they do is they disperse graphite powder in an organic solvent and then sonicate it or mill it in a in a pestle and mortar or a roll mill, which exfoliates layers of graphene. So that's one way to make it. So you just get like bits of graphene. So that sort of thing can be used for probably not the electronics, but I'll come to the kind of things that that can be used for later. And then that's suspended in a dispersion in some sort of liquid, usually organic solvents, but 2D Tech's also looking at using water with isopropyl alcohol as well to suspend it and make it stable. And the other way to do it is chemical vapour deposition, which I'm sure many of you are aware of. And it's grown on copper foil then, which can then be etched away, and the graphene is put on a polymer substrate, and then that can then be transferred onto something useful like silicon or whatever for use.
I think perhaps we ought to mention the materials that the graphene has, because I think we've avoided the mention that it's the greatest of all wonder materials ever, isn't it?
So yeah, for those of you who don't know, graphene is super exciting. It's the thinnest known material. There may be others thinner, but this is the thinnest one we found so far. It's 200 times thinner than a human hair. It's 200 times stronger than steel. And a hammock made from a single sheet of graphene would support the weight of a cat. Now, that's something I'd like
to
see.
That's a mental image.
It really is.
I'd buy that hammock. I've got two cats that need suspending.
I've also got two cats.
It's the most conductive material known to man. It's transparent, it's flexible enough to be folded, and it's completely impermeable. So, yeah, that's pretty cool stuff there.
We'd need to get it into some technology.
Just do something with it.
There's all sorts of things you can do with it. So one of the researchers at 2D Tech, a guy called Craig Dawson, is working with a company called Disol to put graphene into solid-state perovskite photovoltaic cells. So they could be, they reckon they cost about a third as much as silicon PV cells, but they're quite inefficient. So if you put graphene in it, they can help make it more efficient and collect more of the electricity, the electron flow that's produced to make more electricity. So that's quite exciting. And also carrying on with the renewables theme, they're also looking at putting graphene into something called redox flow cells, which I hadn't heard of, but they're basically enormous batteries, sort of the size of a building. They've got porous carbon electrodes and liquid salt electrolytes. But if you put graphene in the electrodes, it sort of increases the surface area, it makes them more stable, increases the conductivity, so of course it makes them more efficient, which would be good.
The heaters in this room appear to be clanging.
Yes, they really do.
Which is just what you need when you're recording a podcast.
Oh my gosh.
Shh! They're not listening to me.
We might have a quick break and come back to you in a minute.
I think something's actually trying to get through the wall.
So hopefully the Brazilian samba band in the walls has quietened down a little bit, and get back to Helen's piece on graphene. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. So, where were we?
I wonder if graphene is any good for soundproofing.
It does everything else, I don't see why not.
Yeah. It's good for all sorts of things. Where did we get to? So we've just done lithium batteries, and that they might be able to make them better as well, which is good. Because my phone battery life at the moment is about 2 hours, so anything that would make that last longer would be quite good. But yeah, there's lots of other sort of slightly less high-tech projects than super-duper batteries and amazing solar cells and such like. Now, consider your LED television. You may not have considered it before.
I consider it every hour, every day.
They make a lot of heat. And they all have, between all the processors and whatever, and the outside world as such, they have a heat exchanger. Now, obviously, components don't always fit together perfectly, so between the processor and the heat exchanger, there's a sort of paste or a foam-like material to kind of insulate it, connect them both, and make sure that the heat is pulled away from the processor as fast as is as humanly possible, or not
mechanically
humanly,
possible.
Mechanically possible, perhaps. Now, they've discovered at 2D Tech that if you put graphene in this foam, thermal interface material it's called, it makes it really, really super conductive of heat and draws the heat away even faster. So that could
Did they just stick bits of graphene in everything they could think of?
Yeah, because why not?
It's just that
not
good.
The answer I was expecting, but yeah, no, I see.
As far
point.
As I can tell, they are just putting it in everything. Take, for example, you've been in a car accident, you've had your jaw smashed up a bit, you need some new teeth. Put graphene in your teeth. Not only will they be stronger, but the graphene-reinforced plastic, something called PEEK, polyether ether ketone,
it expands and contracts at a similar rate to bone. So if you're eating ice cream, it'll be far less painful. It's quite exciting, really.
So graphene is coming to every product you own everywhere, potentially?
Pretty much, as far as I can gather. You can use it for everything, from really, really high-tech kit, like touch screens and solar panels, to less high-tech kit, like thermal interface material.
So are we expecting that there's going to be some scale-up revolution in the short term, and we're just going to see a tipping point and it's going to flood into our lives?
Well, Nigel Salter at 2D Tech, I asked him that question, and he thinks it's just sort of going to sneak in, that people will just sort of, you know, gradually find new ways to use it, and rather than there being something incredibly new and amazing and better, it's just lots of things are going to be a little bit better, a little bit at a time, and gradually there's just going to be graphene everywhere.
So it's going to creep in below the radar?
Yeah.
The radar made of graphene.
Yes. So it's quite exciting, really.
Did you know that iCHEMY offers a modular human factors training programme for the process industries? Human factors in health and safety covers the top human factors issues in major hazard sites. Programmes are currently delivered in the UK and Australia. Find out more at www.icHEMY.org/human factors.
Our final feature this month comes from David Brennan of Monash University, who has a lot to say about why engineers need to get better at saying things. So David, you wrote the piece for TCE on communication, and I think that communication is a... When you think of engineers, you don't really think of communication being such an important thing. So I suppose I'm asking, why is communication an important thing for engineers and chemical engineers in a particular?
Right. Well, once you enter the profession, it really is part of the job. I don't think it matters which area of the profession you enter, whether it's research or design or operations. It's still very important. For example, in research, the quality of your research publications are an indication of the value of your research. In design, it's just so important to communicate the basic concepts of your scheme that you've designed, usually a process in the case of chemical engineers, and communicating that through to the more detailed stages of design, right through to operation. And if you're in operations, there are a huge number of people you have to communicate with. And this is one of the things that really impressed me when I first graduated. I joined a chemical manufacturing company, it was ICI Australia, and I was in a chlorine factory, and it was just a social explosion. The variety of people I had to communicate with was huge. There were operators, maintenance people, accountants, engineers of different types, managers, a whole range of people. And their skills and knowledge, education levels, as well as their personalities, they varied enormously. And you had to communicate with these people as part of the job. You had to write operating instructions for process operators. If you wanted a job done on a plant, maintenance job, you had to write a request for the maintenance job, and you had to outline the task and perhaps include a sketch. If you were writing an expenditure proposal and you wanted to spend some capital, you had to put up an expenditure proposal, put it to management, talk to the accountants, make sure you got the cost estimates correct, all these sorts of things. So it is just so much a part of the job.
Hmm. I suppose that one of the stereotypes of engineers that's out there is that they are, as it were, you know, uncommunicative and fairly sort of only concerned with facts and with data rather than talking to people. Do you think it's something that we need to work around?
Yes, well, I think there is that natural characteristic about a lot of engineers, that they are sort of gadget conscious.
Yes.
They're interested in machinery and opportunities to
integrates them into the profession. But it really isn't enough to have that skill. You've still got to be able to communicate your ideas to other people, because you can't do it all on your own. You can't pay for it yourself. You can't operate it yourself. There is quite a chain of communication involved.
As communication is so important, how do engineers improve their communication skills, do you think?
Well, I think it all starts with education. I think it's so important at school. I mean, everybody does English at school and has to write essays and so on, and read literature and interpret literature and so on. But also, I think at university, we have to communicate through design reports, through laboratory reports. The communication exercise is there. I think it's a question of how well it's done and the standards that are set and the guidance that students receive. And I think that more emphasis needs to be placed on this. And it doesn't finish, of course, at graduation. People do postgraduate work, then they need to be assisted in the techniques of conference presentation, publications, writing research articles for journals and so on. But even in after graduation, there are lots of ways in which we can improve our communication skills. And one little thing I included in the article I wrote was my experience at Rostrum Club, where it was a sort of a speaking club, public speaking club.
Right.
And we got practice in chairing meetings, taking minutes as a minute secretary, giving prepared speeches, giving speeches off the cuff, where somebody would say, you get up and give a minute's talk on circuses or something like that. Something you're completely unprepared for, and you just had to do it. So I think that was a great way for me to gain confidence in speaking publicly, and certainly helped me in my academic life. But I think there are lots of areas where we can improve, and I think writing is very important. I think it's a great shame that engineers don't write more about their work experience. And it's very much part of research that you have to publish your research findings. But so many people in fascinating areas of operations never write about their work, and I think that's a great shame. So I think we need to keep practicing after we've graduated, and you know, always strive for perfection. The other thing that's very important, I think, is to understand who we're communicating with and understand their capability of understanding what we want to say, and just understanding what the best way is to communicate with them. But I think basically we as engineers need to work harder at this communication area and keep it going right through our professional lives. And we have to work as hard at that area as we do at others. One little area that I didn't mention, which I think is very important, is that I think we have an important contribution to make to policy making on a national level. We have enormous skills and knowledge, but I don't think the value of that knowledge gets across into public policy making, and that's an area we really have to work harder at.
Just before we go, we have something else that is incredibly futuristic and wonderful to talk about, namely the TC Today app.
Yay!
It's finally arrived. Yep, we've had quite a lot of readers, members saying over the years, really want to be able to read TC on the go and download it. Well, we've created a new app, and it's published, and it's available on the App Store for Apple, the Android store and also the Kindle Fire store for members to download. They can simply log in, they can download latest issues of TCE and take them on the move. So if you're working on an oil rig and you've got a bit sketchy internet connection, or you're working in a desert location, or you're just travelling by train, you can now download issues of TCE magazine directly to your phone, to your tablet, and read them on the go. So if you want to download it, you can simply search for iChemy the Chemical Engineer, or just simply iChemy, and the TCE app should pop up. You then just simply download it to your smartphone and away you go.
Very nice. Well, I think that's about it for this month. If you have any feedback, then please get in touch with us through Twitter, where we are at TCE Today, or you can email myself at richard@ichemy.org. That's a richard@ichemy.org. Until next month, however, that's it from us. So thank you for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.